pleased me more if the group could have been felt free to have come down a little near the front. But since you're pretty well scattered over the crowd, I guess a small scattered shot would get all of you. It was my hope, as I've been tracing and trailing over the country during this school, it really was a diversion to be able to get out while others were working here, hustle some eggs, some chicken, potatoes, do all those things. And I had come to the pass, had come to the thinking that now the school is about over. I've been blessed in such a way as never to be troubled by having to speak to you at this Bible school. And I have been so relaxed in the matter that I had not thought of anything to say. But you heard what Brother Lewis said about when I went off and left my Bible, left my notes, and didn't have anything to govern me by. Well, that's my place this morning. And when I thought this morning of an old veteran who stood before us in his strength of youth and on through his passing years, that always beamed inspiration from Daniel, the second chapter, I thought maybe then I could supply a few things in Daniel and maybe find a few things that have not been heard. Brother Opie Rogers, in his lecture the other night, did justice by this case. Many of you have made references to the second chapter of Daniel. And so, this morning, I'll try, in the length of time that I have, to bring to you a few thoughts that maybe you haven't thought seriously about. Daniel spoke a vision like all the prophets. No scripture is given by any private interpretation, but holy men of old spake as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. So Daniel, in this second chapter, envisioned not only the narrowness of the rise and fall of four world empires, but he looked out beyond that. And those are the things I want to emphasize this morning, the things that are beyond the image of Nebuchadnezzar, not necessarily beyond, but from a general vision, they are. We do recall, and I think I can brief that more quickly than I can read it to you. We do recall that a great king, as he retired to his royal couch at night, having labored during the day and was tired, fell on sleep. Is my voice getting back to the back? And while he was sleeping, he had a dream. Dreams are interesting things to study. I have tried to find out the psychological facts concerning dreams. Never got too far, but I did learn this, that a dream doesn't go straight as straight thinking does. It doesn't follow a definite line. It jumps about. It hasn't power enough behind it to shape it properly, and maybe not to even enter the tympanum and go on to the cerebellum of the brain. So, this king had a dream. And in a dream, he saw things that he didn't understand. And of course, he had to have some help. He had those fellows who were soothsayers. We have many of the clergy today who are soothsayers. They say what the congregation would like to hear. And we had many others. So he called in the wise men and told them, says, I've had a dream and I'm terror-stricken. You look in the eyes of this picture here, you'll see that terror. I don't know whether you can see that very well. It's not very well placed. But in those eyes look like the most deathless terror that I can conceive. And I think the artist did a fine job on that. And he said, I got to have some information. All of a sudden he said, you've got to tell me something. I've had a dream. I can't tell what it was. And I want to know the dream and the interpretation of it. So they said, no king, the potentate, the power ever asked so much of the people. Tell us the dream and we'll give you the interpretation of it. He said, you practiced lies at my court for so long, and one edict is coming forth. Unless you tell me the dream and give me the interpretation of it, your houses shall be cut to pieces and consigned to the dunghill. So those men were stirred up, of course, knowing that they had been fakes all of these years. Now they'd met their common fate. He passed an edict that all the wise men of Babylon should be slain. Of course, Daniel, having been captured at Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, Babylonian Empire, had moved into Jerusalem and had taken four boys, the finest type of characters they could find, brought them to Babylon. There they had given them the king's meat, or tried to, but they refused to take it. Daniel said, I'm taking the strong meats and the strong drinks. I have purposed in my heart that I would not defile myself. And he said, then, there's only one thing left. I must have the interpretation, or you're going to be slain and your houses be made a dunghill. So Daniel heard it, and his three companions. He belonged, as it were, to the five wise, to the four. His companions and he made up the Jewish boys that had come from Jerusalem. He did not like to see the men, the fakes killed. He wanted his brethren saved. He said, why is the king so hasty? Take me before him. I'll tell him the dream, the interpretation. Not that I can tell him, but there's a God of heaven that rules in the kingdoms of men and setteth up whomsoever he will to rule in the kingdoms of men. So he wanted some time, and he was granted the time. He went to his room, turned his face toward Jerusalem, and prayed that the God of heaven might reveal unto him the king's matter. And God did. Remember the thought. It's no wisdom of my own, but there's a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and make known to King Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. I want to call your attention now to the 28th chapter, the second chapter of Daniel, and we'll probably get into the facts in the case. There is a God in the heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to King Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and thy vision upon thy bed are these. Now he's begun to tell him what they are. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came unto thee while thy head was upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter. He that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. There stands that Hebrew boy who defied everything that the king had offered him. You recall that he said, don't force the meat and the drinks upon me. Try me for 3 days or 10 days or however many days. Give me pulse to eat, beans to eat, and then bring me out before the rest of the Babylonians and see how I stand in their midst. And when he was brought forth, his countenance shined like like a diamond in the sky. He so far outstripped his fellows that they were glad that they had not forced him to take the stand that they asked him. But as for thee, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any other. I've gone over that. Now notice, thou, O king, sawest and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. The form of that image seemed to strike terror to the very hearts of the people who looked upon it. This image's head is of fine gold. The breast and the arms are silver. This is a representation of that dream that the king had. Its head was of fine gold. Its breast and arms of silver. Its belly and thighs of brass. Its feet and its legs of iron and clay. And on down to the toe period, it was the iron and the clay mixed together. There is some significance about all this. A great deal about this division. A great deal down here in the toe period that we hope we have time to work out. Thou sawest till the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, which smote the image upon its feet, that were of iron and clay, and break them to pieces. There was the iron and the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer's threshing floor. The wind carried them away, and there was no place found for them. This is a leap to the future. This is not a thing of the past. It has no special reference to the past. Power spoken in the past, the prophet was looking far down the winding corridors of time to the future when this would take place. And the stone which smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. The little stone over here, little as it may be, it seemed to snowball as it moved forth to crush this image, which evidently is still prophetic. The stone has hidden himself. He's in behind the veil, waiting until God sees fit to make his foes his footstool. And then he will send Jesus Christ, who before was preached unto you, time after time, the restitution of all things, spoken of with the mouth of all the holy prophets that have been since the world began. And this is the dream. I can imagine as I see that anxious king as he sat there, in the presence of that Hebrew boy, young as he was, revealing something to him that human nature and humankind, with all of its wisdom, could not fathom. This is the dream, and he will tell the interpretation thereof before the king, and we will tell the interpretation before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. As I get a pictorial view of that scene, the scene changes from solemnity, from a moody state, to that state, Thou King art a King of kings and Lord of lords. I, in my imagination, in my vision, Brother Richard, in my dream, I see that king as he moves up and begins to be inflated by the language of Daniel, when he said, Thy kingdom shall have power and strength and glory. So, and wheresoever the children of men, wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of heaven, hast given it unto thy hand, and thou hast made thee ruler over all. Thou art this head of gold. You can begin to understand, I imagine you could really see the face of that great ruler as he sat there with the language of Daniel, bearing rule over all the earth, and was not only a member of this family of four world empires, but that he stood at the head. No doubt the gold had some impression upon his life, like it does today on all of our lives. He said, Thou art this head of gold. No doubt, with vanity and with pride, the king was inflated until he felt like he had heard something that he had been longing to hear, the head of a great world empire. Thou, king, art a king of kings. Maybe I'm getting too far back. Thou, king, art a king of kings, and the God of heaven hath given thee the kingdom and power and glory. Thou art this head of gold. So we come now to the point where we understand the. And he said, he goes ahead and said, that after thee shall arise an inferior kingdom. I can't conceive that took some of the wind out of Nebuchadnezzar when an inferior kingdom was going to override the kingdom of gold. And then, no doubt, there was a mood of sadness that crept over his face. And he said, another third kingdom shall bear rule over all the earth. I can visualize him at this instance where heading a world empire, a minor empire taking over his kingdom. And after that, the Medes and the Persians, the Babylonians, the Medes and the Persians, and then finally, growing up in Macedonia, the northern part of Greece, was a general who had the most indomitable courage and who had been down in Egypt and saw and read upon the tombs of Egypt, the pyramids of Egypt, somebody had conquered so many kingdoms. And he said, those men have conquered many, many kingdoms and many civilizations. And here I am in my early 20s and I haven't conquered a city. He wept because he didn't have other worlds to conquer. Within about 5 years, he overran the Medo-Persian Empire. And at the Battle of Arbela, he drove the Medes and the Persians utter rout and overcame them, established the Macedonian or Grecian Empire, Alexander the Great. Later, we can see the rise, and he says a fourth kingdom, which would be like iron and clay, be partly strong and partly broken. At this point here, 395 after Christ, we had a division in the kingdom, in the image. The East, by the Roman Empire, which became the Roman Catholic Church, the West, by the Greek Catholic Church established at Constantinople. So you can see then the relation that these two bear to the whole world. But at any rate, we've come down and covered the whole situation. I would like to say to you, in my case, that this is a very significant situation. These kingdoms rising and falling go back to 664 Christ, and we find the rise of the Babylonian Empire. And when you think of the Babylonian Empire, if you've never read the story of Babylon, with its walls perhaps 200 feet high and 100 feet wide, where six chariots could run in a race behind around that wall that was four-sided, 15 miles each way, which made 60 miles around Babylon. In that great Babylonian Empire, in the inner courts, Nebuchadnezzar had sat. He looked around and said, this is great Babylon that I have built for my honor and for my glory. We knew that God, we know that God condemned him for that. Out of the civilization, I want to get to this point, whether I have time for anything else or not. Out of the civilization, the art, the religion, which came back, I could talk to you about 1900 years behind this, when Abraham was in the era of the Chaldees, when he was called to come out. And then the periods of dark Egypt, all of those religions, the transmigration of souls, if you haven't read about it, you ought to. Strange though it is, but the religion, the art and the invention and the culture percolated, as we sometimes say, drifted down into medieval Persia. Belief in the immortality of the soul preached by the Egyptians. And that was the cardinal principle that came down in Medo-Persia. Medo-Persia had to bow to Alexander the Great, and Alexander the Great, at a time when he ran over all Europe, time close to the time when the Apostle Paul was making his tours and built roads, so that it made possible for the gospel to be spread over the nation. It was from Athens, the greatest university that perhaps has ever existed. The Apostle Paul grew up at the feet of Gamaliel, and he knew the perfect law, and it was there he got much of his information. Alexander the Great had to yield his place. He had to give up his kingdom. Roman legions were surging to and fro. When he met Rome, he went down. Rome rose, and until 476, it ruled the world. 476, barbarian nations began to run in Rome. Luxury, evil, red lines were established. Everybody had their hand out to be fed in Rome. Nobody wanted to work, it seemed. So there began to be a disintegration in the political situation. But religion had been the chief thing that controlled all these nations. All ancient civilization entered into the Roman Empire, religion being the most dominant. Out of Rome came all modern civilization. And above it all was the religious idea. Transmigration of the soul, immortality of the soul. People don't die. When they die, their soul goes off to the Elysian Fields. We don't have that belief today so much. The Elysian Fields. And they live in the Elysian Fields as long as the body lasts. Consequently, the means of perpetuating the body began back there in Egypt. As long as they could keep the body in the sarcophagus, as we say coffin today, their soul would live. And for those people, they put a little boat in the sarcophagus, in the cabin, and whatever that man liked to eat, little specks of that kind of food, so the soul could come back and ride on the Nile, so to speak, in the cabin, and partake of that food he liked so well. That's what it was out of Egypt. 1,000 years before this 664 Christ, we can close our eyes and see the rise of those pyramids. Now we can look at them and see them settling themselves down into the dust. But what we got out of Rome was the religious religion of the Roman Church, more especially of the Roman Catholic Church. From that, our chief cardinal doctrines have come. And we remember that Rome is styled as the mother of the churches. At any rate, that's something that we may realize where our religion comes from. May we have at the same time a little more pride in what we have when we realize that we came out of the religion of Rome. But some 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago, a young man by the name of Dr. Thomas, whose life was threatened by a raging sea storm, made up his mind, if he ever lived to get to America, that his life would be changed and he'd fathom and work out something that would save an honest, painstaking people, humble people, rich and poor, great and small alike. And it's not necessary for me to go in that further. We know what he did. I'd like to call your attention now, if I may have time, Brother Ben. We have come down thus far into through the things that have been presented before. We've taken them up. Now we come down to the period of world history where I believe I spoke to you about maybe in the before I got out of this about the nations when Rome fell in 474. The nations then begin to rush in. It goes ahead and says in that scripture that 10 kings shall rise out of the Roman Empire. The 10 toes representing the 10 kings. I want to make this suggestion to our young brother Williams, and I'd like to see those toes standing out until they can be seen perfectly. The picture here is not good for you to look at. It has a slant. I know you can't see too well, but you'll follow the history. I could have given you a date, but I wouldn't have time to do it. So now we've come down, but there's something beyond Rome, and that's the thing we're concerned about just now. Something beyond Rome, something new. Something new has happened. While Babylon rose and fell under the pressure of the military might of
the Middle Persian Empire. Alexander the Great failed and fell under the Roman Empire. And so, now we've come down to the 10-toe period. They are very significant. They mean something. And I wish to call your attention about this time to some of the things that we are concerned about in the 10-toe period of this kingdom. It's interesting to note, brethren, sisters, and friends, it's interesting to note that it's been our happy lot. It's been our happy lot to see and behold the things the apostles and prophets desired to look upon, but were not permitted. We have seen this one go only through retrospect. We've got to look back. We've seen this one go, this one, and we have lived amid this one. Now something happened when Rome fell. The barbarian nations were right at the throat of Rome, boring. 351. They were in there boring, trying to get a hold of the Roman Empire, even before it fell. So they began to figure out which of them were going to be able to take over the Roman Empire since it's on its face. The 10 main divisions, I think I know them by memory. I've studied it enough. This is something that was interesting to me in high school. I was fortunate enough to have the history of high school. By the way, Brother Matt Treadaway was there. He could tell you something, some of the things we had. He had a different mind than what he has now, but he certainly did quiz me along the line of this situation. We have the barbarian nations that came running over Rome to take over. They were summed up in the Suevi, the Lombards, the Burgundians, the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths, the Angles, the Franks, and all of those fellows, and some others I could give you. The Angles, that word angle, and as I remember when I was in Arizona my last 2 years teaching school, that they called all English-speaking people Anglos. So my Anglos were very few in the school. Most all of them Indians and Mexicans. But anyway, out of the Anglo-Saxon barbarian tribe, England raised her head. Out of the Franks under Charlemagne raised their head, and they're called Frenchmen. We have then we have the Suevi. Portugal stands up today as that image. The Burgundians, we have the Swede people. And the Suevi is Portuguese, the Saxons English, and the Lombards for the Italians. The thing I'm trying to show you, not that they have faded completely out of existence, but they stand up today as evidence for the forecast of the prophet of God. 10 toes, surely that's where we are. We've been the recipients of a great blessing. Being able to look back from the point where we are, see the rise and fall of those kingdoms, and then take your history and read it word by word. Then you understand that God is dealing with humankind. And then when you come down, our trouble, it seems to me, has been locating the toe period. I found greatly to my satisfaction that situation. It may not be true, I think it is. The tribes were victorious. They made a victorious invasion, and the fall came under little Augustus. So the fall of Rome completely fell, and then the barbarians began to have trouble as to who would take over. Rome was divided. Here is something new. Another world kingdom was not to follow. That's one point I'd like to leave with you. Each of the others was to be succeeded by following. The sequence stopped here as a world empire. Each of those bore rule over all the then known world. That's as far as the prophet went. But he said that ten kings should rise out of them, and then another king speaking great swelling words, no doubt, emperor of Rome, papal power of Rome. We'll not go into that, however. Rome was divided. Something new. Kingdom was not, no kingdom was to follow that bore rule over the earth. Rome's mighty empire began to disintegrate and decay. Luxury, poverty, vice, and wickedness, like white ants, bored at the very heart of Rome. The Germanic tribes, they were sometimes called the Hun. I learned that that was one of the tribes earlier, but I believe this is called in a little different name, the A-L-M-A-N-N-I. Alemanna was a German tribe here, but I have known it as the Hun. The German tribes invade from without, and the Roman kingdom was divided and fell. Ridford has something to say about it. At last, the seals were loosed, and the barbaric hordes, like a tornado, poured out of the north. Through the Alpine passes came the rushing cohorts of warriors under the leadership of Mohammed. Something very interesting as we move into this thought. Mohammed had many followers, of course, as we know. We think that he must have had the law of Moses when he wrote his Bible, the Quran. But that be as it may. Ridford said, at last, the seals were loosed and the barbaric hordes poured into the north through the Alpine passes. With a rage of sith in their nostrils and icicles in their beard, those rusty fellows who were coming to make war. Right now is one of the greatest issues that religion and Christianity ever had. Daniel now presents to Nebuchadnezzar, the king, and the tragic efforts of men to unite Europe and bring under the world control and to continue world control among the ten toads of Rome. And whereas those thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, and they shall not cleave one to another. I want to call your attention to that in passing. Today, we have a situation in Europe that I don't have to tell you about. You know that there is a force from the northern Europe that is stimulating so much activity in Central Europe and in Egypt and in India that no peace has found anywhere. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of many, and they shall not cleave one to another as iron is not mixed with clay. We have reached that stage, brethren and sisters and friends, when nations will not cleave one to another. If you had a handful of iron, and even if it was in small pieces, and a handful of clay, and try to force them to amalgamate, to get together, they would not stick. You open your hand, it all fall out. We have reached that stage in world history where nations will not cleave. Go wherever you may. Today, we have a world empire, not a world empire, but we have a controlling force in Algiers or somewhere in the African section. Tomorrow he's gone. America, with all of our democracy, is having a lot of trouble to mix and hold together our democratic principles dealing with an iron fist, the iron fist of Russia. So we'll reach that stage. A nation today don't know what it'll be doing tomorrow in Europe. Never was there so much turmoil. Never was there so much uncertainty in all the world's history. Nobody knows what to look for next. So, we have reached that period. This does the Bible declare with the utmost simplicity and clarity that the nations of our time cannot be permanently united by man. This conclusion we have come to, that the nations of the world will never more be united into a world power as it has been. That's something new. We've come to that period of time. Now let's see if we've had any effort made to revoke that edict that four world powers should rise and dominate the earth, and there the curtain falls. We find in history, and I'll call your attention to it, a number of characters which surpass perhaps any of the marshals or presidents or military leaders that have ever lived, and they have tried and failed. Six notable characters have stepped forth upon the stage and sought to demonstrate that the kingdoms of Europe can be successfully ruled by one throne, under one federation. So in 1939, the sixth set out to try. The first, and one most notable, was Charles the Great, or Charlemagne. He began to rule at the age of 19 years. 14 years before his death, while Charlemagne was kneeling in worship at Rome, the Roman emperor placed upon his head the crown of the Roman Empire. Though Charlemagne was kneeling, and that was the thing that I'm about to repeat there. The Pope placed upon his head the crown of the Roman Empire. Two strong factors were in his favor of taking over the world. Yes, the first was that they desired the unity of the Roman Catholic Church, and they thought that Charlemagne was the man to do the job. And he'd be able to unite all the forces of Europe under one head and under one religion. At that time, the Mohammedan hordes were pulling out across the Pyrenees Mountains, breaking through the passes of the mountains from Spain, moving in there with the Christian people who were trying to get on their feet, get an organization that would hold. They had been beaten by these people many times. It was a question of religion as much as anything else. So, Charlemagne seemed to feel the bill for a man to stop the Mohammedan in their onslaught. Charles Martel, who was his grandfather, 68 years before that, had moved into that country with an army that had never been defeated and drove those Mohammedans back into Spain and had sealed them off there for all these many, many years. Of course, that made him believe that his grandson, Charlemagne, would be able to do the same. And when they met at the Battle of Tours, which is another decisive battle of the world, it was when religion was at the crossroads. This is the time, brethren and friends, when religion would have fallen, maybe everlastingly, before the advance of Mohammedanism, or for ages, to say the least. They met Charles Martel, upon the battlefield of Tours, and he defeated the Mohammedans and drove them again back for the final time. Religion had a time and a chance to breathe and get its feet on the ground. And so that's why it's considered as one of the decisive battles of the world. Read the Battle of Tours. You'll be impressed. It'll raise your spirit to see how our religion has stood the test of time, not necessarily our religion, but the religion from whence we somewhat came. Charlemagne died from weary for a half a century of fighting. He was fighting to unite the nations of Europe. This is what he said. I cannot make the iron and the clay mix. I have tried for half a century to bring under control the nations of Europe, but I'm unable to make the iron and the clay mix. You think he'd read prophecy? You think he'd read the second chapter of Daniel? Charles V, Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, he stepped out and with his Roman legions attempted to run over the world and capture the world. He had to surrender and say he couldn't accomplish the job. Louis XIV tried the same thing. He rallied all of his legions and tried to overcome the forces that existed. He failed. Then comes a great master of destiny. An Italian by blood, a Corsican by birth, a Frenchman by nationality, Napoleon Bonaparte. Napoleon said, I'll stop them. I'll conquer the world and bring them under my sway. A little man, 5 feet 2 inches high, a thin, pale, sallow complexion, with eyes that gaze upon ye out from under a heavy eyebrow, and it said the strongest would cow in his presence. He said he could conquer the world, but when he went into Russia and lost about all the men he had and starved to death, he said, God has been too strong for me. The thing I'm trying to tell you, that we're talking about the 10-toe periods. That's the period in which we are today. Those nations, those generals I'm making mention of, are not ancient necessarily. Ancient history began when the historic curtain first began to rise on the Nile and the Euphrates. It comes on down to the fall of the Roman Empire. Modern history begins the fall of the Roman Empire and comes on down to the discovery of America in 1492. Modern history begins at 1492 and brings us on down to the present. So, 6 men since the days of Rome have tried. Who knows anyone who's had more courage than Charles Martel? Who is able to set at flight the armies of the aliens, made it possible for religion to live and breathe and grow, and finally for Christadelphians to have their place in the affairs of the religious affairs of the world. So we have come down now to the close of my lecture. It's an interesting thing to know that there is a God of heaven that rules in the kingdoms of men, and set us up whomsoever he will to rule in the kingdoms of men. But it's in the days, our trouble has been, it's in the days of these kings. What kings? The kings after the fall of the Roman Empire. The kings that have made an effort to re-erect the Roman Empire through all of its power and influence and have failed. That's a new thing. No man, no number of men, no organization, no political situation, no religious position can defeat the purpose of God. 4 kingdoms should rise and stand and dominate the earth. They have. Out of that have grown 10 kingdoms, and they stand today. Yes, we know France is here. We know England is here. We know the Lombards, which is Lombards, Spain is here. And we can come on down and find the 10 they're standing up today. It's in the days of these kings now, these 10-toe periods. These are the kings. These are the days when the God of heaven shall set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, but it shall break in pieces and consume all other kingdoms, and it will stand forever.